Walker's radio show was on at Disney in 1933 when Walt and some animators were working late. They clicked it off, not wanting to disturb Walt. 2 days later, Nash was trotting his milk wagon down Hyperion Boulevard and saw the Walt Disney Studios Home of Mickey Mouse billboard. "I'd never heard of Mickey Mouse," Nash said in an interview with animator Milt Gray. Nevertheless, he tied up his horses, walked in, and asked to see Mr. Disney. They probably assumed he was a milkman. Jackson eventually called Nash back to the studio for an impromptu vocal audition. As Nash started to go through his spiel, Jackson surreptitiously pressed the intercom button. Up in his office, Walt Disney started to hear birds. Walt knew those impressions. 2 days earlier, that voice had been on the radio doing turkey and chicken impressions. The animators had turned it off, but Walt had asked them to turn it back on. A man who could sound like animals and make them funny should have a home at an animation studio. And now that man was tweeting right downstairs? Walt slipped into the room as Nash continued to perform. "There's our talking duck," Walt said to Jackson. "Mickey's death knell," Leonard Maltin wrote, "was sounded in 1934 in the form of a squawk." Clarence Nash would become a utility man for the next few years for Disney and other studios, voicing whatever odd creatures the animation department decided to bring to life. Animators usually did their own voices. Nash was made the first paid voiceover artist in animation history, but the push for better quality demanded it. Walt Disney, at this point in his animation career, was at a loss not for gags or for stories, but for capabilities. Even working at peak, his crew could only crank out a 7-minute short every 2 weeks. Ideas were piling up like unread magazines, ideas that might never be developed. One of those was a retelling of The Little Red Hen, and another was a talking duck film. At some point, those two ideas merged into a short about a wisecracking duck who refused to help the little red hen make her bread. Nash also picked up work at iWork Studio. While recording, he saw storyboards of a new cartoon with songs by Man About Town Carl Stalling. The title on the storyboards? The Little Red Hen. It was only a matter of time before Nash's duck talk would be in a cartoon. A funny voice could make a star. Ask Chico Marx, Betty Boop, or Mickey Mouse. If you doubt that a voice actor could be so important, imagine Warner Brothers without Mel Blanc. Clarence Nash's Donald Duck was on the auction block. Where would he go? Nash knew Walt and iWorks had bad blood between them. He had in fact gone to Walt to make sure doing voiceover work at iWorks was okay. Walt gave his blessing to all barnyard noises. "Just not any dialogue," he added. What Nash saw at iWorks Studio was a lead role for a talking duck, and everyone with a radio knew Nash had an ace duck voice up his sleeve. Would his work at Disney dry up if he acted for iWorks? Walt might consider it a betrayal, but he hadn't made an offer yet, had he? iWorks had, and Nash was freelance, so he went with the bird in the hand. iWorks won Donald Duck. The studio had finally caught a break. The answer to the studio's prayers waddled in on recording day and sat in front of the Power Cinephone mics, ready to squawk. But there was a technical problem with the equipment. Nash was not able to lay down any tracks. The session was canceled. He went back to his day job at the dairy, his recording delayed. As he toiled, Nash realized he was in possession of valuable knowledge. iWorks and Disney were helming identical cartoons. Such twin productions were a plague in Hollywood, and once word got out, one studio would usually blink and cancel. Never, though, had a game of chicken been about actual chickens. If Disney continued producing an unreleasable film, it could seriously set them back. Out of loyalty to Walt, Nash dropped a dime to Disney's switchboard operator to warn him that iWorks was making an identical hen cartoon. Today, Nash would be fired and sued, possibly by both companies. Back then, he was being a stand-up guy. A secretary took Nash's message. Walt called Nash back later, but this time Nash was out. iWorks then called Nash, but Nash dodged the phone call since he needed to talk to Walt before talking to iWorks. This phone tag continued for 3 days. Walt finally left a message with the operator of the dairy to pass on to Nash. That message? Tell Nash not to do a damn thing for Iwerks. There was no better way to get on Walt Disney's good side than such a demonstration of devotion, especially against Ub Iwerks. I like the loyalty of that guy. I'm going to put him on payroll, Walt announced. Nash started on retainer, but he quickly upsold himself to Walt and became a full-timer. Roy couldn't have been too happy to hire someone whose job description was quack. But Walt had learned the hard way that fidelity, like Hyperion Avenue, was a two-way street. As Nash was coming in, Bert Gillett was on his way out. The Three Little Pigs director accepted a job heading up the Van Buren studio, which had a distribution deal with RKO. Gillett would improve the Van Buren product, acquiring some licensed properties from the Funny Pages and increasing the per-cartoon cost. But he couldn't keep up with Disney's quality. No one could. What was it about Disney that was so special? Why did Disney survive instead of a Van Buren or an Iwerks? The dueling Little Red Hens provide the apples-to-apples answer, the same story told two different ways by Mickey Mouse's two creators. The Iwerks Little Red Hen features more naturalistic movement, but characters still seem to pause between actions, the tell of an animation cycle. Some of Ub's favorites stop by, an earthworm to be eaten, for instance. The story cycles as well. 3 times the Little Red Hen asks for help, is rebuffed, and tackles the task herself, with the help of her chicks. Iwerks told Little Red Hen straight, with a minimum of bells, whistles, or memorable moments. For instance, when the hen asks her animal friends for help, Iwerks used the same exact clip all 3 times, which saved budget but made the cartoon boring. The 3 animals also have the personality of wet cardboard. You could switch the ducks' and pigs' voices without notice. The 3rd animal is a mouse that sounds just like Mickey and wants the reward without doing the work. Yet another not-so-coded message to Walt. Now watch the Disney version called The Wise Little Hen. Iwerks had lost Nash but won the battle to register the title Little Red Hen. Disney's opening features twice as many chicks, all moving around in random patterns, their tufts of feathers a cheery summer yellow, with huge black eyes and adorable white booties. That's money on screen. Better paints, more drawings per second. The camera zooms in on the mother hen. She has large, separated eyes and a more expressive, happy face than Iwerks' hen. Again, this is money on screen. Hours of pre-production design work made her a cartoon, not just a drawing. The hen waddles to her neighbor, the chicks in a happy swarm instead of in Ub's tidy queue. First, she asks a pig for help. In an astounding bit of animation, Peter Pig, one of the 3 little pigs, feigns a stomach ache and runs away. Disney could make pigs not only act, but overact. The guileless hen visits another neighbor, one Donald Duck. His name is written on a battered life preserver, suggesting he's a retired sailor. This introduction was auspicious, since it immediately elevated Donald, who wasn't even on screen yet, to the same level as one of the heralded pigs. We first see Donald doing a jig. He's carefree and loving life. The authors of Walt Disney's Donald Duck, 50 Years of Happy Frustration, point out that Donald acts and moves very much like a duck. He wasn't just called a duck, in other words, he was a duck. When the hen asks Donald to help, he fakes sickness too. After waddling behind his houseboat, he peeks his head out and winks. Not helping out a single mother? What a stinker. What a reprobate. What a hero. Close-ups of the chicks at work follow. Walt has them pull a horseshoe to plow a field, while Iwerks has them use an egg beater. Both fine gags, but Walt's had an Iwerks-worthy rotation on the horseshoe. Iwerks, meanwhile, chose a Disney-style sight gag. The hen returns to Peter and Donald's Idle Hour Club. Donald, the flaneur, is the vice president, and again asks for help. They once again feign illness, but outmoaning the other. This is comedy gold, still funny even now. After the hen harvests the corn herself, she bakes cornbread and muffins that truly look delicious. She approaches Peter and Donald a third time to offer them goodies. In an inspired gag, they start acting sick before she can speak. Peter's got spots on his tongue, Donald seeing stars, and neither seems long for this earth. "Who will help me eat my corn?" she asks. "Miracle cure. Peter and Donald are suddenly better." Audiences at this point are yelling at the screen not to reward the two hungry schemers for acting badly. They need just desserts, not cobs of corn. With no malice, the wise little hen decides to fill them up with castor oil instead. Peter and Donald end the short kicking each other in their substantial rear ends. Certain stars like Mickey bring out the best in an audience. Others hold up a warts-and-all mirror. Donald could be despicable, yes, but in a way that everyone who stubbed their toe could understand. If Mickey was who we aspire to be, Donald was who we were stuck as. Donald Duck is an escape, a relief from Mickey's inhibitions, Walt said. He is a very outrageous fellow, with bad manners and a worse temper, and everyone is very fond of him, including myself. Donald Duck was quickly drafted to varsity, stealing the show from Mickey in 1934's Orphan's Benefit. He wasn't as rotund as today, but his mannerisms have not changed. Here's an animator describing Donald's febrile manner. "I had him lean forward, chin out, arm straight out and fisted. The other arm with fist was swinging back and forth. His one foot was out straight, heel on floor. The other foot under him as he hopped up and down, quacking. If Mickey did that, children would cry. But it was just Donald being Donald." Donald, Goofy, and Mickey were soon as inseparable as the three little pigs themselves. When Mickey joined the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade in Helium Field Splendor in 1934, his first of four balloons, Donald followed the following year. Donald and Pluto would star in Mickey Mouse cartoons where Mickey never showed up. Soon, Donald got his own series. Kay Kamen did not let this new star go unhitched to the wagon of commerce. There were now mouse, pig, and duck versions of most everything in the Disney catalog. Unbelievably at the time, Max Fleischer was suing anyone who made Betty Boop merchandise, saying, "I'm not in the merchandising business." Well, Disney was. Cartoons were a hobby paid for by the business of bisque figurines. Mickey may have sweated Donald's All About Eve-style rise. He could end up like Virginia Davis, Little Alice. In 1934, she was all grown up, out of high school, and back working for Disney, as an ink girl. Her new uniform wasn't curls, but fingerless cotton mittens to keep skin oils off the cells. The mouse's decline was simple. In the world of Hollywood, where a foul mouth or preening attitude was okay, Mickey was guilty of the cardinal sin of being vanilla. He had no issues to work out, no devil on his shoulder, a conflict-free life. The mouse was weaker tea with each appearance, as flat and thin to the story men as he was on the animation table. No one wanted to write for Mickey, not when they could write for Donald. The New York Sun called Disney out for dropping the ball with its spokesmouse. "Look at the recent Mickey Mouse cartoons and see how they are failing in invention. Mickey is too valuable a trademark, has too many sidelines, too many gadgets, for Disney to be allowed to dispense with him altogether. But there seems to be a reasonable case for thinking that Mickey is becoming more and more a figure of the newspaper strip cartoon." That was good news for Floyd, but a slap in the face for the rest of Team Disney. The Sun was right about Mickey still being gangbusters. Disney reported sales of $35 million worth of Mickey Mouse merchandise in 1934. He was the only animated star of the anthology film Hollywood Party, alongside Laurel and Hardy, Jimmy Durant, and the Three Stooges. He also cameoed in Babes in Toyland in the form of a monkey dressed in a costume that's a nightmare right out of Todd Browning's Freaks. Mickey is a mouse in last name only, which meant Disney could experiment with a true cartoon mouse. A 1934 silly symphony called The Flying Mouse features a little scurrier who wants to fly, then magically gets his wish. He regrets it. It's maybe the only Disney film whose motto is, "Don't follow your dreams." In both message and style, no way could it have ever starred Mickey Mouse. Walt worried less about creative bankruptcy and more about actual bankruptcy, as Roy regularly reminded his brother the sky-high production costs barely cleared the price theaters were paying to rent them. Sound alone was $75,000 per. Worse, the advent of the double feature meant theaters were cutting cartoons and serials. Short subjects were at best a loss leader for the one-crop economy of Mickey and Donald merchandise. The writing was on the wall. In a few years, cartoons would be extinct. Disney was profitable, but in a dying trade. Not even Mickey's millions, up to 50 to 60% of each merchandising dollar, were enough to escape the seven-minute ghetto. To line the coffers, Roy negotiated a terrible deal with the owner of Lowe's. $400,000 in exchange for a third of Walt Disney Productions. Disney existed on razor-thin margins. Giving away a third of their company would have decapitated them. The deal fell through at the last minute, possibly due to Roy's prayers. Another deal for music rights for Disney cartoons did go through. Roy paid through the nose to buy it back later. There were other ways to get seed money. Surprisingly, one way was thanks to UB Iwerks. Iwerks's 20% share of stock had never been divvied up by the Disney boys. Walt and Roy decided to use it as a bonus fund. This would, Walt figured, reward excellence and boost morale for the next big Disney project. What Walt was pondering was an endeavor akin in scope to Noah's Ark. A huge project with a huge expense, a lot of animal, and huge ridicule if things didn't happen the way he envisioned. But Noah saw rain in his future. Walt saw snow. Chapter 27 Snow Job, 1935. Ever since Grim Natwick had moved to L.A., Roy had been courting him. Disney needed animators who knew the female form. During one of their meetings, Roy painted Disney as a studio that offered artistic freedom. Grim had all the freedom he could stand, though. He was basically running Iwerks Studio. Iwerks had pre-sold a lot of work, and Grim found himself a supervisor instead of an animator. The studio was full of young talents, a dozen protégés looking for mentoring. To meet the never-ending deadlines, Grim's work began to suffer. The MGM deal for Willy Wopper expired in 1934, 2 years after Flip the Frog sunsetted. The only work around was the Comicolor cartoons, still made with a day-old bread of a two-strip color process. No one wanted them, so Pat Powers self-distributed the shorts. This worked for Mickey in 1929, but now it was a half-step up from a sheet in an American Legion hall. UB's studio was crumbling. In the latest development of the bed-hopping drama that was 1930s animation, Grim Natwick quit Iwerks for Disney. In hopes of keeping him around, Iwerks offered Grim a 50-50 partnership in Iwerks Studio, but both men could do the math on 50% of nothing. Grim told film historian J.B. Kaufman that, "I think I went into Disney the next Monday. I'd already told Iwerks that I probably would go over there if he had a job." Grim was a rat leaving a sinking ship, fittingly to go to the House of Mouse. Iwerks, the captain, had to stay on board. He accepted Grimm's resignation with his own sense of grim resignation. The new I-10 freeway, Los Angeles's first of many, took Grim from his Westwood home to his new digs in Silver Lake. Grim, like UB, was a technician, a tradesman. Training newcomers and making a quality product was a good living, but it wasn't art the way Grim had experienced when he trained in Europe. What really excited him was Disney's big project. The industry had heard rumors about it for years, rumors Walt confirmed the previous year in print. The Aesop of the 20th century, the St. Francis of the silver screen, was making a feature-length cartoon. One day Walt called a staff meeting in the soundstage. The animators were in a semicircle around their boss. He began to tell them a fairy tale. Instead of just explaining the story beats, he acted all the parts out. This was how he communicated. He was never embarrassed about it, Lily noted. His eyebrows flew up. He made exaggerated smiles. He minced and pranced. Not for nothing is one of the biographies about him called The Animated Man. People were crying by the end, not for what they had seen, but for what it meant. That's going to be our first feature, Walt concluded. This fairy tale of Walt's had a hero and a heroine, an opponent, comic relief times seven, and in Walt's telling, lots and lots of animals. It was a lodestone of emotion. Pride, betrayal, jealousy, sadness, disgust, anticipation, anger, and that was all just the villain. Bank of America floated Roy $250,000 for production. Walt's back-of-the-envelope calculation of one short, $20,000 times 12. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was greenlit. So Mickey was the prince, and Minnie as Snow White? Horace Horsecollar as the woodsman? Nope. Snow White wouldn't use the Disney stable. Chaplin could expand from shorts to features, but not Mickey. The Literary Digest claimed the mouse had played before half a billion paying customers in 1935. None of them had paid feature prices for Mickey, and it was a gamble to think they would. If not Mickey, then who? Walt, believe it or not, wanted human cartoons. Disney had never pulled off a single decent shot of a human, much less 85 minutes of them. This project was like flying transatlantic when you'd never taken off before. Snow White was the biggest risk in Hollywood history, a make-or-break venture for Disney. For all his versions of the Mickey Mouse creation myth, Walt was uncharacteristically mum on why he chose Snow White as his fairy tale. According to J.B. Kaufman, who wrote a pair of 2012 books about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Walt was firm as far back as 1933 on Disney's first feature being Snow White. Why? It made sense to tell a familiar story. People already liked it, and they could fill in any storytelling gaps by themselves. A silent Snow White with Marguerite Clark had been a boyhood favorite of Walt's. He had seen it one weekend in a special 12,000-seat theater. A more recent retelling was via a Bravura Betty Boop cartoon, almost entirely illustrated by one man, not Grim Natwick, over 6 months. But which fairy tale Walt picked almost didn't matter. Disney excelled at not story, but storytelling, not character, but characterization. A bigger question seemed to be deciding on a feature in the first place instead of the easy layup of an anthology film of shorts. Walt had tried out several storyteller characters and silly symphonies to host a possible feature symphony. Santa, Noah, Mother Goose, and Old King Cole. But none distinguished themselves. It was better to start fresh. Hadn't he had started the symphonies in the first place because I didn't want to be stuck with the mouse? Snow White would be Walt's baby, so he considered directing it. As a test run, he took the reins of a King Midas silly symphony called The Golden Touch. It went remarkably badly. The short is over 10 minutes long, with 8 of it filler. There's only one main character, and the few gags are terrible. It was Disney's worst cartoon in years. Walt had lost his directing touch. But Walt wasn't a director anymore, no more than he was an animator or writer. He had invented his own role at the company, an executive without portfolio, whose job it was to predict what audiences wanted, in ways both micro and macro. This position was bigger than director, less focused on finances than producer, and more hands-on than studio head. Walt's role at Disney was to be the man with the golden gut, the ultimate author of everything Disney produced, including Mickey. Kay Kamen was helping Whitman Publishing launch a monthly Mickey Mouse magazine, featuring new text stories and puzzles along with reprint cartoons. The Queen of England and Duchess of York gave out Mickey Mouse plates as gifts to children. The Mickey Mouse clubs were phased out because there was already an unquenchable demand for Mickey. He may have lost out on a part, but this was not a trapped mouse. Mickey got a special gift for his birthday. Color. Black and white always put a ceiling on how good Mickey could look. No longer. All Disney cartoons from now would be first-class affairs. Color Mickey had a new look, courtesy of Fred Moore. Thicker around the middle. More weight to stretch and squash. He had his eyes done as well. they would gain pupils to better convey emotion. His cheeks even moved when he talked. Mickey's first color cartoon, The Band Concert, was also his first Three Musketeer team-up with Donald Duck and Goofy. A new role went with his makeover, Ringmaster. Mickey found his perfect role of shepherding a group of eccentric performers. Donald nails his role as an audience member who keeps trying to join in. From a technical and humor perspective, it's seven of the finest minutes Disney ever strung together. It was conductor Arturo Toscanini's favorite cartoon. As Christopher Finch points on, in the yard of Walt Disney, the band concert features the passing of a torch in the form of a leitmotif. In Steamboat Willie, Mickey whistles, Turkey in the Straw. 7 years later, Donald, not Mickey, plays that song. The short ends with a moment of triumph for the duck, who finally gets to play it. This coup was such a big deal that New York Times ran an editorial on a world where Donald was the hero, not Mickey. Wasn't Mickey supposed to be our guy? Envoys from Argentina bestowed honors to Walt for creating Mickey. Australians sent kangaroos. Russians said that since Mickey was a little guy, he stood up for the proletariat and was a disguised socialist. The King of Siam, age 10, loved Mickey Mouse. A Quebec invalid supposedly laughed so hard he left the theater without his crutches. To keep Mickey's ego tethered to reality, Floyd Gottfredson had Mickey undergo a job evaluation. His experience, ability, and mental rating made him a perfect fit for peeling potatoes in a mess hall. Walt and Roy knew of the global acclaim, of course, but they experienced it when they took their wives on a 10-week trip to Europe in 1935. Roy saw in Walt's stressed-out eyes a possible repeat of the 1931 meltdown and wanted to head it off at the pass. Gunther Lessing would run the studio while the brothers tramped around gathering ideas and 350 European art books. Walt even had a series of Mickey drawings made so he could pass them out as his own work. The Disneys were treated like royalty overseas. Fortune magazine said Mickey was a part of the folklore of the world. In Italy, Benito Mussolini's Topolino-loving children met Walt. Il Duce himself was out of town. In Germany, Roy found a cottage industry of knockoff Mickey merch and did something about it. In France, Walt saw a feature of six Disney films in a row, inspiring him to package six Mickey Mouse films as a French exclusive. Seeing the international impact made him realize his cartoons had way too much talking. Less dialogue meant more global revenue. Polo was one of Walt's few vices, but in 1935, he gave it up forever. He had injured his back playing, and he rode his prize ponies like a bad driver in an overpowered car. He became scared straight in October when two players, one a movie actor, died during one of his matches. From then on, Walt stopped risking his life. Risking his neck on the feature was enough. One neck on the line wouldn't be enough, though. He told his art teacher, Don Graham, "I need 300 artists. Find them." Graham became a talent scout. Disney want ads drew in over 35,000 portfolios. Walt joked that the Great Depression was his real recruiter. The standards for admission were so high, Charles Schulz was turned down. This many new recruits made for a new workplace. Gone was the one big family vibe. In its place was a political landscape where only the connected got good assignments, finding a nearby apartment was tough, and even parking was a battle. The top tier worked on the cartoon feature in secrecy, sitting close to Walt's corner office and drawing gossip as much as they drew princesses. Second tier was the symphonies. At the bottom was Mickey, whose popularity had provided the capital for everything else. This hierarchy would surprise the millions who loved Mickey, tolerated the sillies, and had no conception of Snow White. Grimm was scared his Iwerks years would strand him in the Mickey basement. You didn't want to be left on the shorts if you could help it, Frank Thomas, one of the nine old men, said. To avoid it, Grimm leveraged his friendship with Ted Sears. I said to Ted one night at dinner, "If you ever see Walt in a good mood, you might mention me and say you understand that Grimm would like to work on Snow White." Good timing is essential in animation. A few weeks after that, Grimm was told to free up his Friday night. He had a date with Walt Disney, who was going to show him around the feature studio. Back in 1935, the idea of a cartoon movie was at least three types of folly. There was the financial aspect. How could an animation studio afford to not get paid until the whole film was done? There was cultural. Cartoons grew tiring after 8 minutes. A whole new form would have to be invented to keep popcorn munchers satisfied for 10 times as long. And there was practical. A lot of people were needed. Where would they all sit? Walt had expanded the Hyperion Avenue location as much as he could, and the Bank of America money was for animators, not new real estate. The studio had grown massive. At 20,000 feet, Hyperion was the size of 2 high school gyms. At the end of 1934, Walt was paying 12 men to come up with stories. 85 animators, half of them assistants, drew up those stories. 30 more slashed around ink and paintbrushes. Add in the tech crew and the musicians, and Walt had close to 200 people under one roof. Now Walt was doubling that population. A separate bungalow for the publicity and comic strip employees helped, barely. It still seemed, though, that new hires would have to sit on others' laps, or in the decorative 2-car garage built for Mickey and Minnie's Austin Roadsters. The long-term solution was a bigger studio, of course, which would be built from the feature's profits. The dwarfs were easy to animate, since they were basically mice without ears. Their personalities were going to distinguish them. A bold idea carried through via similar but not identical look and dress. This was the worst of both worlds. Work-wise, 7 distinct forms that the audience couldn't tell apart. Each dwarf would be indicative of a different emotion, and named after his passion. There would be a foil in Grumpy, a leader in Doc, second stringers in Bashful and Sleepy. Various other personality traits were floated. Jumpy, Hoppy, Weepy, Gloomy, Awful, Gabby, Flabby. They settled on Happy, Dopey, and Sneezy. Helpful and Angry were off the table. Mickey and Donald already occupied those roles. Grimm's job was tougher, to create a young woman so immediately believable that audiences forgot they were watching a cartoon. 100 dwarfs wouldn't be enough if Snow White herself seemed stiff or fake. Yet Disney had never succeeded in creating the deep emotions needed for a good, heart-interest picture. It wasn't for lack of trying. Walt experimented with realistic characters in a 1934 silly symphony called The Goddess of Spring. It's not King Midas bad. If nothing else, it yields the trivia that Disney had animated a Hades as well as a Pluto, but the female lead, Persephone, isn't convincing as a real person. Walt wanted photorealism for Snow White. Hair had to fall and drift and bounce the way we see it 1,000 times a day. Ditto for clothing. Each element of the face had to act as if skin is connecting it all. Gait was a huge issue. Real people walked realistically. Veer 1 micron away from truth, and your character will appear to be wearing cement shoes or floating. Standing still was even tough, since people fidget. Grimm's first directing job for Disney was The Cookie Carnival. Grimm was able to make his characters disheartened, proud, humble, and ashamed. Not bad considering they were cookies. His secret was to veer away from true realism. They were merely realistic. The female lead's nose almost doesn't exist. Her eyes are as large as saucers, and her dress is a cupcake wrapper squirted with eclair cream. Yet she moves convincingly, so we accept her nature. Walt saw it and agreed. Reality was no longer the goal. Grimm set to work designing a cartoony Snow White, making her a cross between Betty Boop and Minnie Mouse. She stood much taller than the dwarfs and had a teenager's figure. He tried out red and blonde highlights, plumped up her eyes, and flattened her nose to a sideways lowercase c. His end results looked of a piece with the rest of his animated output, based on circles, not based on nature. Animation historian Charles Solomon said Disney was also considering Shirley Temple for Snow's voice. This cutie pie look meshed with both the dwarfs and with Disney's strengths as a company, but it clashed with the rest of the project. The subdued watercolor background, the earth tone color palette, and the cadre of fantasy illustrators used as inspiration. Snow was a little girl, one whose size made her fit in with the dwarfs. A teenage Snow White was only appropriate for a social problem film, not a Disney feature. Story-driven Walt decided which Snow White, girl or teenager, would be given the rose. The film was going to end with Snow saved from death by true love's kiss, a romantic improvement on the fairy tale's original ending of the Heimlich maneuver. That kiss meant the girl had to be of kissable age, so to avoid scandal, Walt upped Snow's age to 14. As the project matured, she kept changing, as 14-year-olds do. She became more realistic than Grimm wanted her, and more mature than originally envisioned. This problem could have been avoided by casting Minnie, who became girl or woman as the role demanded. Chapter 28, Looney Bin, 1936. One of Mickey Mouse's many 1936 magazine covers featured a reversed white-on-black cover. After staring at it, readers would see an afterimage of Mickey anywhere they looked. It was unnecessary. Mickey already was everywhere. Even un-Mickeyed mice were everywhere at Disney. The Silly Symphonies followed up The Flying Mouse with the Oscar-winning The Country Cousin. They would be followed by a rodent invasion of the 1937 Oscar winner, The Old Mill, Timothy Q. Mouse from Dumbo, Ben and Me, an album featuring Ludwig Mosinski and his All-Mouse Orchestra, Jacques and Gus from Cinderella, Lemmings from a Nature documentary, and the stars of The Rescuers and The Great Mouse Detective. All are mousier than Mickey, and none is much remembered. What made Mickey Mouse popular couldn't be transgenically duplicated in any old mouse. But could popularity be captured anew? Audiences had no idea Snow White was in production. But behind the scenes, there was more action than a David O. Selznick epic. Martin Krause and Linda Witkowski's book on the film, Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, estimated that 750 artists worked on the film, making it second only to FDR's Works Progress Administration in terms of 1930s artistic scope. Everyone was encouraged to contribute ideas, no matter where they were on the internal totem pole. Gate was proving to be a challenge. Animation simplified and exaggerated the authentic movement, but Snow White was supposed to be real. How real should Snow White move? Too cartoony and the audience loses sympathy. Too realistic and you might as well film in live action. Each shot, each frame, was a different compromise. Walt created a new role for himself. Not the director, but the indirector. There was never a final script. Instead, Walt tacked and retacked hundreds of storyboards on the wall, moving shots at random, filming others in sequence as an early animatic. Shots of what would become the movie accumulated like Election Day voting returns. The story was cobbled together from whatever Walt deemed good enough to proceed. This was no way to make a narrative movie, much less an animated feature, where split seconds took days to produce. Thousands of feet of dopey walking were destroyed so newer, funnier footage could be made with dopey a hair out of step. Walt was spot welding the most crowd-pleasing film of all time. "We considered changing the name from Snow White to Frankenstein," he joked of what was being called Disney's folly. Walt experimented with rotoscoping actresses, including Virginia Davis. If it worked, it could save hundreds of hours. However, Snow White, while seemingly photorealistic, has a head as large as Linus and Lucy. She was unrotoscopable. The filmed footage was only an inspiration. The correctly proportioned Evil Queen was heavily rotoscoped, however, using a cheaper photostat process. Walt swore his animators to secrecy about the process. He also built his own multiplane camera. What Ub Iwerks had made from some car parts and elbow grease cost Walt tens of thousands of dollars. It was a three-story monstrosity that looked like a cross between an industrial laundry and a printing press. It was put in the soundstage next to the animation camera. A wheeled chair stood on a raised platform with no lip. One enthusiastic swivel, and you'd go flying down to the concrete floor. This device allowed for breathtakingly complex panning shots. The watercolor backgrounds were magnificent, but as with doing a crossword in pen, one mistake meant literally back to the drawing board. The cell art also looked flat next to it, so an ink girl had to airbrush the edges of each cell to soften the ink lines. Walt had a scale model built of the dwarf's cottage and maquettes for all the characters. Animators focused on creating not shots but entire scenes. They upgraded to larger paper and 3-peg system. It was a filmmaker's dream come true. Complete control over the vocal performance, music, lighting, set, costume, locations, casting, performance, and camera work. There may never have been a film with greater fidelity to its creator's vision than Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Now, if only Walt had a vision. Well into production, he still hadn't cast a voice for Snow. He never decided who should be her lead animator. Grimm ended up getting most of the wide shots, and since no one could make the prince believable, big scenes where the evil queen traps him in a dungeon and he escapes were cut. How appropriate that his one remaining song was called One Song. Roy was hearing a different song from investors, and it wasn't a love song. They were not used to 3 years pre-production on a picture. Not even elephants took that long to make. They wanted a release date which would put the irons to Walt's feet. Ready or not, the film would be released in December 1937. What Walt was making was more than a single bedtime story. The dwarfs contained elements from dozens of radio and Borscht Belt comics. The Queen pulled from a generation's worth of horror films. Transformation from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the intimidating beauty of She, Gothic settings, and Brechtian lighting. Snow's snooze was from Sleeping Beauty, her scrub work from Cinderella. Snow White had everything, even the kitchen sink. Another problem arose during 1936. Roy heard from United Artists, which had been renegotiating its Mickey Mouse and Silly Symphony deal. UA wanted a new provision in the contract, something about iconoscopes, or as they are now known, televisions. Television was radio with images. One day everyone would have one. Farsighted UA decided that from now on, it would own the television rights to whatever it licensed from Walt Disney Productions. That included Snow White. All Roy had to do was say yes, and this problem was off his desk. Television was a 1930s buzzword. "Remember that term," Gunther Lessing said. "It's going to play a big part in this studio someday." But in the 1930s, TVs only existed at world's fairs, as futuristic as flying cars. "I don't know what television is," Walt admitted, but he knew that UA wanted to own it, and Walt refused on principle to sell any part of Mickey Mouse. "I'm not going to sign away anything I don't know about," Walt said, in one of those unheralded decisions that make or break a company. UA should have known Walt would be persnickety about Mickey Mouse rights. He would take his ball and go home, even over a science fiction picture box. UA held firm. All deals must include TV. RKO heard that the Disney contract was up for grabs and grabbed. It had been in bed with Disney for years via sound work from its subsidiary RCA. Color cartoons often premiered at its Radio City Music Hall in New York City. RKO offered Roy $43,500 for each new Mickey and Silly Symphony and would split all profits. Plus, Disney got to keep its TV rights. "In looking to the future, and that includes television," Walt announced, "we believe our association with RKO offers greater opportunities for the broader and more expansive fields of development. As a bonus, RKO also gained distribution rights to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs." This didn't obviate Disney's constant need for more money. Roy suspended all bonuses. Right now, Disney needed the cash more than its staff did. Roy also arranged sale of a 78 RPM record of songs featured in Disney shorts. These weren't covers of Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf or Who Killed Cock Robin, but the very same performances. It was the world's first soundtrack recording, featuring the lilting pipes of Mickey Mouse. Since Walt turned 35 that year, Roy decided to throw him a party. On December 5th, everyone halted work and gathered in the shadow of the studio's multiplane camera for cake. What neither Walt nor Roy knew was that the crew had made Walt a present he would never forget, nor ever allow to see the light of day. In the middle of the party, a projector and screen came out. The overhead lights were shut off, which in a large windowless room with black painted walls was quite dark indeed. A film began. It was short, it was undoubtedly in black and white, and it was of Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse performing the marriage act. The crowd gasped. This was done by Disney animators on Disney time at Disney Studios, and it was being shown to Walt. Burning a church seemed less sacrilegious. Someone began to chuckle. Then someone else. The shock and disgust turned into the best laugh a comedian can receive. The laugh given unwillingly. Everyone laughed at Mickey and Minnie acting out a Tijuana Bible, a dirty cartoon. Even Walt laughed. After the lights were on and people calmed down from their guffaws, Walt pleasantly asked who had drawn his birthday gift. A few proud souls raised their hands. "You're fired," Walt said, his smile gone. Then he left his party. I guess Walt is the only man in Hollywood to whom you don't tell a dirty joke. When you do, somehow it doesn't come out funny, a Disney vice president later said. A few versions of this story end with Walt hiring the two employees back. In others, they remain pink-slipped. Both are credible. As the years went on, Walt found managerial joy in wielding the hammer. You know, every once in a while, I just fire everybody, Walt said in the 1950s. Then I hire them back in a couple of weeks. That way they don't get complacent. It keeps them on their toes. At the other end of the success spectrum, Ob Iwerks spent a fair amount of his year pumping gas. Or rather, he was animating a character pumping gas. Iwerks' studio had so little work the previous year that it had already completed the 10 cartoons it needed for 1935, plus 5 more for 1936. To keep everyone busy, he took on piecemeal work. This pump jockey cartoon was for Warner Brothers, reuniting him with Carl Stalling, who did the music. Iwerks was credited as supervisor on the black and white features, but that was a formality. The fingerprints on the project belonged to two men, Bob Clampett and Iwerks' former cell washer, Chuck Jones. Jones had a brief tenure at Disney as well. He said the only job there worth having was Walt's. Iwerks' star was Porky Pig. Porky had made his debut the previous year, a stuttering pig convincingly voiced by an actual stutterer. Daffy Duck wasn't around yet, so Porky's sidekick was Gabby Goat, the Horace Horsecollar of Warner Brothers. You'd think the union of the greatest hands in the business with two of the funniest minds should have been comedy gold. Instead, iron pyrite. Nothing in the Porkies is bad, mind you, but it's just as serviceable as the Porkies before and after it. Iwerks brought little to the endeavor other than capably realizing other people's ideas. If this gig was an audition to see if Iwerks could have a home at the Warner Brothers cartoon studio, nicknamed Termite Terrace, then he failed the test. The Looney Tunes, it turned out, didn't need Ub Iwerks. Over the years, they would catapult themselves higher and higher, turning bizarre slapstick humor into high art thanks to Wile E. Coyote, Marvin the Martian, Foghorn Leghorn, and Speedy Gonzales. Their bosses had no idea what was going on. Around 1950 or so, Harry Warner said of his animation business, "The only thing I know is that we make Mickey Mouse." Looney Tunes and its spin-off, Merry Melodies, should have been forgotten when Hugh Harmon and Rudy Ising left for MGM because Leon Schlesinger refused to give them a raise. They took Bosco with them, so Schlesinger was out a star as well. But his bench of Termite Terrace animators was oceanically deep. Besides Clampett and Jones, there were Frank Tashlin, Tex Avery, and Disney alum Friz Freleng, whose height and temper would inspire Yosemite Sam. Lockheed had a similar skunk works of talent during World War II, but only Warner Brothers produced an actual skunk, Pepe Le Pew. The biggest star in the Warner lot, though, was from the pen of a Kansas City kid. That kid was Ben Hardaway, a tobacco-chewing animator with time both at Disney and Iwerks under his belt. Hardaway was better known to his co-workers and soon the world as Bugs. When an effortlessly cool rabbit character arrived, everyone knew what to call him. By 1947, the New York Times would report a Gallup poll that Bugs Bunny, his design airlifted from Disney's Tortoise and the Hare cartoon, was the second most popular cartoon in the world behind Donald Duck. Mickey Mouse was bronze. "We were trying to beat Disney," Fritz Frayling recalled, "and they did. Looney Tunes have continually aired for over 50 years. The list of great Looney Tunes characters never stops. Sylvester and Tweety, the Tasmanian Devil, Elmer Fudd." After Iwerks' two Warner Brothers cartoons, Clampett and Jones continued working at Iwerks' studio without Iwerks. It was a fine place to draw, but they didn't need supervision. The fall from grace of the world's greatest animator continued. Now his desk was in higher demand than he was. Worse, of Iwerks' eyes weren't working. "I found my eyesight was going from doing too much animation and staring into that bare electric light bulb beneath my drawing board." Beethoven going deaf was a tragedy. Iwerks going blind was a farce. Chapter 29, The Forecast, 1937. Walt began 1937 by claiming another award for Mickey's mantle. The J.C.'s named him their Outstanding Young Man of the Year, probably assuming that Snow White would be a huge hit. Little did they know that going into 1937, Disney had not completed a single scene, shot, or indeed frame of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Almost every Disney hand would be devoted exclusively to the feature. Disney still managed a short or two. Modern Inventions became the final Disney cartoon released by United Artists, finished in January and distributed in May. It featured Donald Duck cheating his way into a technology museum, where he gets deservedly abused by the robo-servants. By summer's end, the new distributor, RKO, already had its first Disney product to release. The Mickey Mouse cartoon, Hawaiian Holiday. For the first time, the whole Disney canon appeared. Minnie dances a hula and Mickey plays the ukulele. Donald catches his tail feathers on fire during a luau. Goofy tries to surf and ends up buried in the sand, and Pluto wages war with a starfish. There's not much story, just old friends saying aloha. The dream of a feature symphony came true in May of 1937 with the Academy Award review of Walt Disney cartoons. Disney's five best animated short winners were reeled together and presented as a feature. No Mickeys or Donalds padded out, they never won Oscars, so it clocked in at a cash-grabby 41 minutes. Disney counts Snow White as its first feature, but this precedes it. Frank Churchill wrote and recorded 9 songs for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Amazingly, most all survived to the final cut. The convention of the time was for movie songs to be unrelated pop ditties between the story chunks. But Churchill's songs told the story. The song, "I'm Wishing," solved years of exposition headaches, for instance. The contentedness and work ethic of the dwarfs came through in "Whistle While You Work." Ditto Snow's longings in "Someday My Prince Will Come." Showboat started the trend of the modern musical, but Disney popularized it. Howard Hawks's famed definition of a good movie was 3 good scenes, no bad scenes. No one could guarantee good scenes, but Walt became merciless in cutting anything imperfect. Even great moments were excised. Scenes with the dwarfs slurping soup or building a bed were cut for pacing. Midway through 1937, Walt Disney Studios became the little engine that couldn't. Edna Disney said of Roy that it was A little harder for him to be optimistic when he could see the payroll going up and up. Thanks to no air cooling, there were days when the ink and paint crew couldn't work, since sweat would ruin their art. Walt would have to take hat in hand to Bank of America and ask for just a bit more money. The overage amount he asked for was what in 1934 he had sworn would be the film's entire budget, $250,000. A Disney legend was born that day. Walt assembled as much raw footage as he could for the Bank of America man and showed it in a small room used to review film, nicknamed the Sweatbox. His animator's eye watched the banker for a sneer of disgust, an eyebrow raise of delight, an open mouth of wonder. Nothing. The Sweatbox was as icy as an igloo. When it was done, the banker reacted for the first time. He yawned. Disney was doomed. Before he left, though, almost as an aside, the banker shared his feelings about the project. "Walt," the money man said, "that picture will make a pot full of money." Roy got his loan and immediately started to burn it on 15-hour double shifts, but it came at the cost of the residual value of the short subjects. In other words, they had to mortgage Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck to get Snow White out the door. Part of the money went to post-production special effects. For shadows, the cameraman would superimpose a second cell containing a shadow over the first cell, creating a ghostly double exposure. Miniature sets were built to capture the shadows. For the ever-changing sparkle of running water, they filmed a thin sheet of tin. For a candle, the film was double exposed with a flickering light. The magic mirror was photographed through a wavy layer of distorting glass. Snow's rosy cheeks were so realistic, a rumor started it was done with real makeup. Some shots required up to 6 separate cell layers, including dust, blush, shadows, flame flickers, water, suds, or rain. The multi-plane shots became more of a multi-pane. The device collected 5 layers of dust on its plate glass. Bulbs close to burning out would change color, ruining an exposure. Shots took all day to assemble, but it produced work of dazzling complexity. When Snow runs away from the huntsman, she passes in front of perspective-blurring beech trees and then behind a boulder, then passes still deeper into the shade of the forest. The mind gives up trying to figure out how it's done and simply believes. Disney would win a 1937 Oscar for its multi-plane camera. One more handful of salt rubbed in Iwerks' face. Viewers of Disney shorts over the years received sneak previews of what to expect from the feature. 3 orphan kittens experimented with tricky perspective shots. Little Hiawatha included scary forest imagery. The old mill existed to experiment with a multi-plane camera. Woodland Cafe filled up the corners with dozens of different critters. The Worm Turns let Mickey's basement lab resemble the Queen's dungeon. Even the following year's Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod included a fantasy sequence from a cut song. The days flew by as December loomed. 6 months before release, the animation team had to create 70 feet of footage a day, every day, to meet their deadline. 3 months before release, when other films focus on advertising and promotion, Snow White was still being animated. 2 months before release, it was still being inked, painted, and photographed. Roy hired Harmonizing's staff to help with last-minute inking and painting. He also subcontracted an entire symphony to them. Merbabies. 1 month before release, the $250,000 was gone. But the crew was as emotionally invested as Walt and Roy. Some staffers took pay cuts to keep working. Others agreed to be paid the next year. After so much unpaid overtime, what was a few more weeks worth? Disney was now a 24/7 rent party. Nervous marketers from RKO asked Walt to shorten the name to just Snow White, since romances were more popular than fairy tales. Walt refused. 2 weeks before deadline, Walt was still making the background department repaint the organ Grumpy plays. Walt felt it was too big. On December 1st, it was still being photographed. 4 days before its first airing, more fine-tuning. The final result of 4 years of effort was 7